You are the only human being on a vast and deadly planet. Frightened? Then you're ready for this week's Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. More about that scary Halloween version of our theme later in the show. What I'm even more excited about is my conversation with the author of The Martian, Andy Weir. We'll get to that right after we hear from Emily Lakdawalla. Bill Nye is on the road this week after joining us for a very joyous celebration of the Planetary Society's 35th anniversary. Bruce Betts was also at that big party. We'll hear his preview of the night sky and get another space trivia contest underway with What's Up. First, let's head out beyond Mars to the vast reaches of the asteroid belt. Emily, as we all recover from that glorious 35th anniversary celebration, there is news from Ceres. Tell us about these new images.
Well, these images are not actually new, but they're new to the public. Hmm. And this is how things work on all NASA missions. All NASA missions return images, which are science data from the mission. And the scientists have some time to examine the images, make sure they're all complete, make sure the spacecraft doesn't need to send any other data to make them complete. They calibrate them. They make sure that the data are perfect. And then after this period of data checkout is over, which usually lasts about 3 to 12 months, they send all of the data to something called the planetary data system. And once the data is in the planetary data system, anybody in the world can use that data to do whatever they want to, either science or, in the case of my blog entry here, making really beautiful pictures.
So you've been in touch with some of your colleagues who've been doing exactly that. Tell us about these. Are these the first color images?
Yeah, you know, for reasons I've never been able to understand, the Dawn team has not released any color global portraits of Ceres. They released some images that show variations of color on the surface, but those are scientific photos where the color data is heavily exaggerated to emphasize differences from one place to another. But members of the public, often we're not that interested in the science as much as we are in what would it look like if I flew there and saw Ceres myself. These images are intended to answer that. They're intended to simulate what a human eye might see while they were there, although it's not a perfect simulation, but it shows you this subtly colored surface, vaguely brown, with the bright spots peeking out of the craters. And it always feels more real to me to see these color images of planets and moons and smaller objects in the solar system.
They all look great, and it's a very diverse group, but you included a caveat that you've sort of hinted at there.
That's right. So these images, for a number of reasons, they don't perfectly represent what the human eye would see. One of those is that they're not precisely calibrated. The amateur image processors took red, green, and blue filter images, combined them into color, but without any direct knowledge of how the different intensity of red, green, and blue are supposed to be next to each other, you can only guess at the overall cast of color. We know that most objects in the solar system tend to be somewhat red because reddish colors happen when you bombard surfaces with cosmic radiation and the solar wind. Ceres is going to be slightly reddish, but exactly how red it is, these people didn't know. They just did their best to simulate.
All right, Emily, we will be talking more about Ceres and the Dawn spacecraft. In fact, we'll be doing so on the evening of November 4th. We'll be putting an announcement up about this at planetary.org very soon when you and I join Mark Raymond, the mission director and project engineer, on stage at Cross Campus Pasadena at 7 p.m. on the evening of November 4th, that specific time, and there will be a live webcast. So watch for the announcement of that. We'll say something else about it next week. And I look forward to seeing you there, Emily. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt.
She's our senior editor, planetary evangelist Emily Lakdawalla, also a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Bill Nye has the week off as he travels back across the country. So up next, a very special conversation with the author of The Martian, Andy Weir. Who'd have thought a hyper-realistic story about a man stranded alone on Mars would become both the number one best-selling book and the number one movie in theaters? Well, you might have thought that if you were as thrilled by The Martian as I was. I was equally thrilled to join its creator a few days ago. I talked with Andy Weir for nearly an hour at a home in Los Angeles. It was one of the most enjoyable conversations I've ever had for this show. You'll hear a few excerpts here, but the entire interview is online at planetary.org/radio and elsewhere. It includes Andy's thoughts about protagonist Mark Watney and his other wonderful characters, how protein bars can destroy a rocket, and what the crew of Andy's Mars spaceship Hermes could have had in common with the Donner Party. Also, why we should and possibly must colonize Mars rather than the moon or someplace else, and why nuclear reactors in space will be essential. And even pays tribute to Opportunity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover. Andy Weir, I am so proud to have you on Planetary Radio. Thank you for being here. Thank you for that great book.
Thanks for having me.
I got two words to start with. Duct tape.
Pretty critical words for our hero.
Mark Watney, your wonderful character in the book. He says at one point, oh yeah, duct tape will work in near vacuum when it's really cold. Is that really true?
Yes, it will. Actually, they used duct tape on the Apollo 16 mission. I'm probably wrong on that. But one of the Apollo missions has to be 15, 16, or 17. They had a problem with the rover. And the fender of the rover had broken off, and it was kicking lunar dust up at the astronauts. And so it was a significant problem. And so they took the operations manual and duct taped it into place to make a makeshift fender, and it solved the problem.
They
Mark Watney did, yes. Or either that or Mark Watney, I know, Gene Cernan did, or whoever did that. I don't remember. It has to be Apollo 15, 16, or 17, because those are the only ones with rovers.
There was a particular Apollo mission, which I heard you, I think you told Adam Savage in the terrific interview that he did with you. He was such an enthusiast, such a fan, obviously the same way I feel. You talked about a different Apollo mission being, if any of those helped inspire The Martian. Which one was it?
Well, Apollo 13 was one of the biggest inspirations, of course, with everything that went wrong and then everybody working hard to get the astronauts home alive. Surely that one was pretty critical. If you look it up, every single one of them had a bunch of problems. Mm-hmm. None of them nearly so life-threatening as Apollo 13, but a lot of them had near-abort situations where they almost had to just give up, but they worked through them all.
Yeah, they worked through it, as Mark Watney does, of course. I read the book months ago. I've now seen the movie twice, better in 3D, but loved it both times. I had to reread the book. I'm just going to skim it, I thought, a couple of days ago. I ended up pretty much rereading the entire book. I'd kind of forgotten how awe-inspiring it is to find, if not some really clever observation or solution on every page, the pages that didn't have one of those had some funny joke. Sometimes, often, it was both. I just am amazed at how the action proceeds and the detail that you went through to build this. I'll give you an example. Before Watney leaves on his trek across Mars, he cooks all of his potatoes. You explain why that was an important thing to do, and he could only put four in the microwave at a time. Oh my God! How did you go through this process as you developed this amazing story?
It's just the way astronauts do their thing. You solve one problem at a time. You don't try to think about 20 things at once. You say, okay, what is the issue I'm dealing with right now? Solve that.
Work the problem. And then
move on to the next one. And so, as you mentioned, with the potatoes, cooking them. Thing is, cooked food takes less energy, takes less of your energy to digest. That's why cavemen started cooking food. I mean, they didn't realize it, but that's why that was such a huge technological advancement. We don't think of cooking food as a technology, but it is. The heat breaks down a bunch of the complex proteins inside the food, and that makes it easier for your body to digest it, which means it takes less energy, which effectively means that the food has more energy.
He got more internal pirate ninjas, you're saying.
More pirate ninjas, sure. Well, it's funny. If you do dimensional, so pirate ninja, for those of you who haven't read the book.
And by the way, I fully expect that the regular audience to this program has read the book and seen the movie. And if they haven't, it's their own damn fault. So don't worry about spoilers.
So we're the beginning of this discussion is a spoiler warning. And yeah, okay.
That's right.
Pirate ninjas are kilowatt hours per soul. And if you a sol is a Martian day, and you know kilowatt hours is actually a unit of energy. So if you do the dimensional analysis, it's a power. It's a power. So and somebody worked it out online, and it's I think one pirate ninja is actually 40.6 watts.
How did you approach it? Did the problems, did the challenges come first, and then you had to figure them out, just as Mark Watney does in this story?
Yeah, pretty much. That's what I did. I mean, I would come up with the problems first. Usually the problems just presented themselves. It'd be self-evident. It'd be like, well, he's got this problem now. And when they weren't, I just tried to think of what is the most likely problem he would have next. What's the next? I mean, his equipment's all well past its intended use duration. He's got all, you know, all these issues. I would think of the problems first, and then I would try to think of the solutions. Usually, there was a solution. Now, I have the advantage of being able to spend as long as I want thinking about it. Watney, he's very smart, very clever, very resourceful, and fearless, and he can come up with, in a few minutes, he can go, oh, okay, I got it. I know how to solve this. But, you know, it took me weeks to work that out.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, I couldn't come up with a solution. Sometimes, I would have a problem, and I'd be like, yeah, that'll kill him, and there's nothing I can think of to make him not die. Then I would cheat. You know, because I'm the writer. And so I'd go back into, and I'd say like, okay, if I can't keep him alive, and if I like the problem, I'd figure out what is the smallest little piece of technology that he would need to have to solve this problem. What is the least invasive, most likely thing that he would have on a space mission that would help him solve this problem in some clever way? Then go back in the earlier chapters and mention it here and there so that from the reader's point of view, it was there all along.
I don't know of another movie that has stuck as close to the book as the movie that most of us have now seen, Ridley Scott's film. I mean, obviously, a few things had to be left out. But I mean, do you feel the same way? How do you think they did with your work?
I think they did a fantastic job. I mean, the adaptation is very true to the book. There's a bunch of stuff that they had to take out, of course. Otherwise, it'd be a six-hour movie. But the things they took out are things that if they'd left it up to me, if they'd said, all right, Andy, you have to trim this down to 2 hours. What do you take out? I would have taken out the same things. And Matt Damon absolutely nailed the character of Watney. He is exactly the way I imagined Watney.
I told you some weeks ago, the first time we ran into each other, that this book reminds me in so favorably of a guy I think you read as a kid, Robert Heinlein.
Oh, yeah.
Because it is so inventive and so clever, but also the character of Mark Watney. He's kind of a wise guy. He has a good time when he's not, you know, fighting for his life. And the humor seemed very much like the kind of stuff that Heinlein would let his protagonists participate in. I love this character, and I hope you take it as a compliment.
Oh, I definitely do. Thank you very much. Yeah, Heinlein is one of my, what I call him, the holy trinity of authors that I look up to. Heinlein, Asimov, and Clark. Those are the guys that I grew up reading because my father had a giant, inexhaustible supply of books, sci-fi books that he'd collected over his life. And so I ended up reading basically baby boomer era sci-fi, so 50s and 60s stuff, even though I'm a, you know, a Gen Xer myself.
More of Andy Weir, author of The Martian, is just a minute away. This is Planetary Radio.
Casey Dreyer here, the Planetary Society's Director of Advocacy. The New Horizons Pluto encounter was NASA at its best. But did you know that it was almost canceled twice? It was saved by thousands of space advocates who wrote and called Congress nearly a decade ago. Today, more missions are threatened by budget cuts, including a journey to Europa and the Opportunity rover on Mars. You can learn more at planetary.org/standup. Pluto was just the beginning.
Hey, Bill Nye here. I'd like to introduce you to Merk Boyan.
Hello.
He's been making all those fabulous videos, which hundreds of thousands of you have been watching.
That's right.
We're going to put all the videos in one place, Merk, is that right?
Planetary TV.
So I can watch them on my television?
No.
So wait a minute, Planetary TV's not on TV?
That's the best thing about it. They're all going to be online. You can watch them anytime you want.
Where do I watch Planetary TV then, Merk?
Well, you can watch it all at planetary.org/TV.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan with more of special guest Andy Weir, author of the number one best-selling book, The Martian. If you think Andy is entertaining in this conversation, you should have seen him on stage with Bill Nye at the Planetary Society's 35th anniversary celebration. Or you can hear our complete nearly one-hour interview at planetary.org/radio.
You told Adam Savage in that great conversation that you had with him that you actually worked it out. You picked a particular date for the Ares 3 launch. You ready to reveal that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, because people have already worked it out.
Oh.
So Ares 3 left Earth orbit on July 7th, 2035. And the reason I know that is because I worked out all the orbital dynamics, all the things that Hermes does in the book. Those are real orbital trajectories that I calculated for Hermes' acceleration and stuff.
So 2035, pretty advanced spacecraft. And in fact, in the story, it's been to Mars already twice before Ares 3, right?
Right.
Wow, that's optimistic. I could only hope that you'd be correct about this timeline.
I think it's probably very optimistic. I think more likely, speaking realistically, so you need to remember, I wrote The Martian to entertain, not as an actual prediction, right? And the purpose of The Martian, and I freely admit this, I shamelessly pulled on your nostalgia heartstrings by making it feel like the Apollo program. Everybody loves thinking about the Apollo program. So I'm like, it's the same thing, right? I mean, we've got it. It's named after a god. You know, it's Ares, right? And it's like all NASA and America, hooyah, you know? And, you know, with some international cooperation, we've got Vogel, who's an ESA astronaut, right?
Yeah,
and stuff like
yeah.
that. But realistically, I think, you know, if you're asking for predictions, my guess is the first manned mission to Mars will be a large multinational effort. I think it'll be organizationally similar to the International Space Station. I think it'll be the U.S., ESA, Roscosmos, the Indian Space Agency, JAXA. I think everybody will work together because it's incredibly expensive. They'll make a nice big ship, and they'll send an international crew to Mars. And so I think that's much more likely. And I also think it won't happen until maybe around 2050.
So you obviously think this is an important priority. People should go to Mars.
I do think it's an important priority. However, I want to be clear. I think we should have a long-term goal of having human self-sufficient human population somewhere other than Earth.
Mm.
Doesn't have to be Mars. Could be Titan. Could be Europa. Could be the moon. But somewhere other than Earth, because once we do that, our odds of extinction drop to basically zero.
So now I got to ask, what do you think of the initiative that began at JPL and actually at the Aerospace Corporation, which the Planetary Society did its Humans Orbiting Mars workshop about, calling for an orbital mission and maybe a stop at Phobos by the mid-2030s?
I love that idea. I love the idea of a manned orbital mission because it gives you the best of both worlds, no pun intended. Remember, if all you're trying to do is gather scientific information about Mars, there is no compelling reason to send humans to the surface. Now, I'm going to get there. 10,000 people are like firing up their email clients right now to send me, you know, angry grams. But listen, what I'm saying is, yes, right now, right at this moment in time, a human astronaut on the surface of Mars would be way more effective than any rover technology we currently have. But that's not going to be the case for very long. And if you consider the cost of sending humans to Mars and returning them safely to Earth and all the safeties and secondary and tertiary systems you need when human life is on the line, then if you took that money and instead put it into making better robots, you could very quickly have a robot that's not only as capable as a human astronaut, but superior. The only problem is it doesn't have a human brain, right? So getting around the surface, taking samples, doing analyses, doing sample returns even, stuff like that, that can all be done remotely, but the thing that is on the surface doesn't have a human brain to draw conclusions and make decisions about, ooh, I didn't even notice that rock before, but now that I see it, I want to go over there. That's where an orbital mission comes in, because you have a effectively zero latency decision process for that robot. So it's effectively the same as having a human brain in control of everything with no latency. As it is, our 4 to 20 minute latency between here and Mars makes everything really slow. You say, like, okay, rover, go over there. Okay, and in about 40 minutes, we'll find out how that went. So I love the idea of an orbital mission to Mars. We would first litter the planet with robots, not just one, but a whole bunch of rovers for the humans to control once they get there. And they hang out in orbit for a while, a long-duration space flight, and then they come home, which means we don't need to land them safely on Mars. We don't need to get them up off of Mars. And that just dramatically simplifies the manned mission.
There's a scene in the movie where Mark Watney is actually feeling pretty bad about his chances at this point, but he's sitting on a bluff looking out over this absolutely gorgeous Martian vista. And he's the only person on the planet who can see it because he's the only person. Would you hope that someday, I imagine like me, you don't really expect it to happen, but would you like to see that vista?
Not in person, no. I would not go to Mars. Even if it were as safe as commercial air travel, I would not go to Mars. I write about brave people. I'm not one of them.
You and Ray Bradbury. But you wouldn't mind a virtual reality representation.
Sure, I'd love to see pictures, and I'd love for other people to go to Mars and then tell me about it.
I don't think anybody has ever done a better job of pretending to go to Mars and telling other people about it than you have in your book. And you know the competition for that statement is pretty tough.
Well, thanks.
Thank you so much for this conversation and for this magnificent book, which Joel Achenbach of the New York Times said he thinks you may have single-handedly helped to save the space program.
Well, that's probably a bit of an overstatement, but I do think there's a virtuous cycle in progress right now. There's more public interest in the space program, which causes more demand for entertainment about the space program, which will in turn drive more public interest in the space program. So that's like a virtuous cycle, the opposite of a vicious cycle.
Earth will come to fear your writing powers.
Well,
thank you. Thank you very much. This has been such fun, and I'm just delighted that you were able to take the time.
Thanks for having me.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. The Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society is Bruce Betts. He joins us here, as he joined us many times, actually, on stage last Saturday during our 35th anniversary celebration. I enjoyed all of your random space facts.
Oh, good.
they were very random.
Well, that's part of the goal. I don't always achieve it, but in this case, I do. I feel badly when they aren't as stochastic as they could possibly be.
Nice bit with Amy Meinzer as well. I hope that all of this is going to be available as video at Planetary TV very soon so that many more of you can enjoy it, more than the 3,000 people in the packed Pasadena Civic Auditorium. For now, tell us what's up in the night sky.
The end of the night, the pre-dawn sky, still popping with planets. We've got Venus and Jupiter both there, two brightest planetary objects, brighter than any stars, Venus being the brighter of the two, and Mars, much dimmer and reddish. This is all in the pre-dawn east, and there you can watch them move relative to each other from one morning to the next. Venus will be getting closer to Mars, and Jupiter will be getting farther from Venus. But that's the planetary party is in the pre-dawn. You can still check out Saturn in the west shortly after sunset, but just hanging out solitary. We move on to this week in space history. It was 2004 that the Cassini spacecraft had its first Titan flyby. It is still flying by places like crazy, just partying with Enceladus these days.
We have a very special random space fact intro. Now, anybody who heard the theme up front, I said I would explain what that was about. And I'm going to leave that explanation until after we hear this. Here we go.
It is time for another random space fact.
Not bad, huh?
Oh, very, very nice. Very cool. Tell us about it, Matt.
We have to thank Paul Bergel for creating that for us. Paul is the music director for a Coney Island-based horror show called Phantom Creep Theater. He improvises music for the silent horror films that they show as his alter ego, get this, the Decomposer. and these guys, Phantom Creep Theater, they also have a very entertaining podcast. I've listened to a couple of episodes. It's called, what else? Phantom Creep Radio. And I really want to go to their monthly Midnight Monster Hop, which is at a New York City tiki bar called Otto's Shrunken Head. And for that intro, Paul had a special guest, Moloch the Mighty, who is the host of their show. So, Paul, thank you for making this a very special Halloween show.
Yes, thank you so much.
You still have a random space fact after all that?
Yeah, but I feel like it's just not creepy enough.
Okay. We'll be the judge of that.
It's a little tiny bit creepy. It's certainly weird. The sun's magnetic field changes polarity. approximately every 11 years, happens at the peak of each solar cycle as the sun's intermagnetic dynamo, that was kind of scary, reorganizes itself. The sun's polar magnetic fields weaken, go to zero, then emerge again with the opposite polarity. So north becomes south, south becomes north, chaos ensues, zombies, apocalypse, you get the idea.
I am shaking in my boots. I'm actually barefoot, so that's difficult.
All right, let us go on to the creepy trivia contest, which was kind of creepy because I apparently confused the daylights out of people. But here was the question. As of 1980 and 2015 each, so this was part of our sequence celebrating the 35th anniversary of the Planetary Society, I asked, how many worlds had either been soft landed upon or had successful atmospheric probes? With the following important caveats. Note that I count spacecraft not designed as landers but that survived after landing, but do not count touch and go or fly through sample returns. This was a tricky one, apparently.
Many people would agree with that last statement because...
Sorry.
A whole lot of people who entered, and there weren't really that many because this was a tough one, a whole lot of people did not count one pretty significant world among those that would qualify, and that was Earth. We had one correct answer in this admittedly small group, and it came from a guy who usually just entertains us but doesn't win the contest, Torsten Zimmer in Germany, who said, as of 1980, four worlds soft-landed, atmospherically probed, Earth, Venus, Mars, and the Moon. And then since then, up to the present, we have added Jupiter, Titan, Eros, and our favorite, well, I don't know about that, Comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, just last year. So congratulations, Torsten!
Sorry for those people's minds I bent, and hopefully learning occurred.
We are going to send Torsten a Planetary Radio t-shirt and a Planetary Society rubber asteroid. We had a few of those on stage over the weekend. So, Torsten, you can call that whatever asteroid you like.
Was I supposed to keep those to give out? I threw them at the audience.
No. We have a few more back at the office.
Okay.
Not a problem. All right. How about next time?
All right. Next time. I really was desperately looking, as apparently the audience is looking, for something a little more concrete. So here it is. In honor, we just gave out the Cosmos Award to Neil deGrasse Tyson, but it honors, of course, Carl Sagan. What was Carl Sagan's middle name? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
So here we are at the other end of the ease of question spectrum. You can get yours in to us by, you've got until November 3rd. That's Tuesday, November 3rd at 8 a.m. Pacific time. And the prize, once again, it's pretty cool, I think. Not just a Planetary Radio t-shirt, but we will give you one of those. Bill Nye's greeting on your answering system, your voicemail, whatever you're still using. Anybody still have a cassette-based system out there? Anyway, Bill will record a personal message to go out to all of your friends and family and robocallers. How's that?
That's pretty cool.
You can say goodnight, Bruce.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, think about what your brain does when given confusing questions. Thank you, and good night.
Mine just basically shuts down. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up? Boo!
Da!
Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its highly resourceful members. Daniel Gunn is our associate producer. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear Martian skies.